Okay, as we finished up in chapter 3, you remember that Paul made the point that we're all sons of God, not by anything that we did, but through faith in Christ Jesus. So we're all sons of God. And he said in verse 29, if you belong to Christ, because you're a son of God, then you're also Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. And since we're heirs according to the promise, through Abraham, we might want to know something about this inheritance that we are to receive. I know in this life, in my life, I don't have a rich uncle that will pass on and give me lots of money. So I'm open to hearing about any inheritance that I could possibly receive. Well, it turns out we've already received this one. I'm speaking to you who have been born again this morning. And so he picks up in chapter 4, verse 1, saying, now I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a slave, although he is owner of everything. But he is under guardians and managers until the date set by the father. Interestingly, in Roman philosophy and way of life, when a man had children, they were not immediately considered to be heirs to the father's legacy. If he was rich, they were considered heirs, but they were not considered sons in the house until it was a ceremony with a long Roman name that I don't really want to try and prattle off and impress you with my great knowledge, of which I don't really have that knowledge anyway. Basically, there would be a ceremony, kind of like a birthday or a bar mitzvah or something, but it was not set on a certain day or time or even year of the son's life that he would go through the ceremony. It was when the father, it was a date set by the father. It was a time that he looked and said, he's become a man. I can trust him to be the heir. And he would actually go through an adoption process. That's the way the ceremony worked. You would actually adopt your own son to be your legitimate heir. And so he says that he doesn't differ at all from a slave. He was actually under guardians. He was considered as any other slave in the house. Now, that was back then, and now, how can we understand that? Without delving into historical documents, how do we understand that? I'll give you an illustration of how we can understand how the heir is considered a slave more than an heir when he is a child. There is a guy not a lot of people know about him, or maybe you haven't heard of him. He's kind of obscure. His name's Bill. Bill Gates. Anyway, if you're a Windows user or a user of Microsoft products, you helped add to Bill Gates' massive fortune. You know, his net worth today is over $50 billion. $50 billion. Now, don't covet that, all right? He is much less happy than you. I can guarantee if you're a Christian today, you're far more happy in your middle-class poverty than he is with his $50 billion. But one thing that has brought happiness to him, his wife, Melinda, gave birth 4 years ago to their daughter, Jennifer Catherine Gates. She's 4 years old. Can you imagine being the four-year-old daughter of a guy with $50 billion? Now, I don't think there's even a way that you can comprehend that, but we know that one day she is going to inherit quite a bit of money. She is going to receive millions, if not billions of dollars as an inheritance. But you know what? Today, she doesn't have access to it. Today, Bill is not entrusting those $50 billion to four-year-old Jennifer. She doesn't get to make decisions regarding it. It's not in her control to spend it as she pleases or invest in various things. As a matter of fact, she has as much control of that money as Bill's limo driver. Not at all. Now, Bill's limo driver is just a hired hand. He's a servant, isn't he? Jennifer, four-year-old Jennifer, is the same as the limo driver. She's the same as a slave until when? Until a day appointed by her father, as Paul says. So she's no different than a servant in regards to that inheritance. And Paul's going to draw that analogy now. He says in verse 3, so also we, while we were children, were held in bondage under the elemental things of the world. You know, every person in the world is like little Jennifer Gates, because we all have been given an inheritance or a promise of a legacy. You say, well, I missed that one. Way back in Genesis, God promised Abraham that all the nations of the earth would be blessed through his seed. Remember that seed we covered before was singular, talking about Jesus Christ. There's an inheritance to be found in Jesus Christ, open to all the people of the world, to every nation. Every one of us can be blessed through that seed, Abraham's seed, Jesus Christ. But you know what? Before Christ came, everybody in the world was just like little Jennifer Gates, having been, it seems like I'm going to inherit this great thing, but being bound under the law, being a slave, no different than a slave in regards to being able to access it. Something had to happen first. A day, as he says, set by the Father. And so in verse 4, he tells us about that day when the fullness of the time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Therefore, you are no longer a slave, but a son, and if a son, an heir through God. So, Bill Gates one day will decide, he'll look at his daughter and say, you know what, I can trust you with some money, or I can give this inheritance to you, or, you know, you're really growing to be a fine young woman. Hopefully he won't decide that when she's 6 or 8 or even 18. I can't imagine if somebody gave me $1 million when I turned 18 or even 21. But hopefully sometime in her 40s, old Bill will say, old Bill will say, you know what, it's time that you receive that inheritance. Or he may wait until he passes away and it's written in his will that she receives that inheritance. It'll be a date set by the Father. Well, the Father in heaven, God, he set a date. And when the fullness of that time came, he sent Jesus Christ to redeem us, to buy us out of that slavery to the law. And you say, I'm not getting that slavery thing. Well, we were all enslaved to the law. The Jews had been, it had been given to them in stone on the Ten Commandments. And if they violated the law, the penalty was death. So they were in bondage to it. They were enslaved to it. And you say, well, I'm not a Jew. Well, God wrote that law on our hearts. When we're born, the heavens declared the glory of God. All the earth declared his handiwork. His righteousness was known to us, and it was written in our hearts. We have a conscience. And each one has violated his own conscience, just like each Jew broke the law. And so we're under the slavery of death, in bondage to death. But Jesus redeemed us out of the slavery. He bought us out of this slavery. When God sent his Son, born of a woman, he was bound under it, fulfilled it perfectly, and bought us by his own blood to buy us out of that place. And because, he says, you are sons, in verse 6, God has sent forth the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father, Abba. Now, other than a Swedish band in the 70s, a lot of people don't know what Abba is. Maybe you didn't get that either. I'm sure my age is showing. What does Abba mean? Well, Abba is a Greek word that today would be best translated daddy. It's a word, it's an affectionate term for a father. In olden times, they would have said, oh, that word is best translated papa, okay? But it means daddy. In our vernacular today, it means daddy. It's a heartfelt, intimate name for dad. It's daddy. Now, the rabbinic writings, the commentaries on the Mishnah and such, tell us that slaves in a household were not allowed, it was a violation of the law, to call the head of the house daddy or Abba. It was wrong for a slave in the house to call the master of the house papa. That was something that was reserved only for children. Well, God sent forth his spirit into our hearts, and now we cry out, Father. When we pray, our Father who art in heaven, we're bearing witness that we're children of God. It says in the book of Romans in chapter 8, he says, you haven't received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons by which we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. When you pray and you say, Father, I just received Jesus Christ cleansing for my sin, you're bearing witness that you're a child of God as you pray to him, Father. Someone who has not been born again has no right to call God Father because he's not or she's not been adopted as a child of God. And so reciting the Lord's Prayer, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, for someone who's not been born again, who does not know Jesus Christ, who has not had their sins forgiven, it's actually a violation of the law. A slave cannot address the master as Abba, Papa, Daddy. He can't do that. It's a violation of the law. But you, the fact that you do that, bearing witness that you're a child of God. And now Paul says, however, at that time, in verse 8, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those which by nature are no gods. But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how is it that you turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I fear for you that perhaps I have labored over you in vain. What has Paul confounded here? The very reason that Paul is writing this letter to the Galatians is that he can't understand why, okay, they were slaves before, they were made children of God, heirs to the promise, and now they've reverted back to slavery again. They've put themselves in bondage again. He doesn't understand how they went from slave to free to slave again. And he says that you're in bondage now to these, or turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again. He says, what are these weak and worthless elemental things? They're the things of the law. For he even points out here, he says, you're observing days and months and seasons and years. Now, don't read that wrong. Observing days and months is not a sin. If I was to say, hey, Tom, what day is it? And Tom glances at his watch. He says, well, it's August 13th. And I say, ha-ha, a sin. You observe days and months. That's not what it's saying. It's talking about the days and months and seasons and years, the new moons and the Sabbath days, these things dictated by the Mosaic law. He's saying, you guys were Gentiles. You were never under bondage to these things. And now you were adopted as children of God, and you're not in bondage to that, but now you're choosing to go back. He's saying, I don't understand why you would do that. Now, The observance of days, it's great that you take Sunday. You're observing the day if you really think about it. You come to church on Sunday morning and you worship God and you're taught his word and you fellowship with his people. And so you're observing Sunday as a sort of holy day. But you're not esteeming one day above another. You're not saying that, oh, Sunday is the only day. Sunday is mandated. As a matter of fact, the very reason that you're able to come to this building on Sunday morning is because the owners of the building choose to worship on Saturday morning. And so they're free to worship on Saturday morning. We're free to worship on Sunday morning. You know, if we could just divide all the churches of the world into seven equal parts that worship God on any given day of the week, we'd have, you know, seven churches meeting in every church building. Oh, we worship on Monday, we worship on Tuesday. And you know what? That's okay. Because God never said to Christians, you've got to worship on Sunday morning, you've got to worship on Saturday morning, you've got to do this. We worship because we desire to. Now, my desire is to worship God every day of the week in a different capacity. I wake up and I'll begin to pray and just share my heart with the Lord and seek his heart for me. That's every day. And I'll open the Word and the Word will speak to me in my devotional times. That's every day. And sometimes I'm at church, and sometimes I'm at the office, and sometimes I'm just driving around the hills appreciating the nature that God created. I'm worshiping God every day. And Romans 14:5, Paul said, one man regards one day above another, and another regards every day alike. Let each man be fully convinced in his own mind. Are you convinced that Sunday's the day? Fantastic. I'm convinced that every day is a day to worship God. That's great too. I'm fully convinced of that. But don't let anybody begin to give you a hassle. Don't ever go to somebody that attends this church on Saturdays or goes to this church building on Saturdays and say, oh, you're in the wrong day, man, you're on Saturday. And don't ever let one of them say to you, oh, what are you doing on Sunday? That's wrong. Because the scripture clearly says, Colossians chapter 2, verse 16, let no one act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day. Don't let anybody judge you for how you worship God or what day you worship God on or observing these things. But listen to this. He makes reference to the festival, the new moon, or the Sabbath day. He says, things which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. What does that mean? A lot of people misinterpret that verse or don't understand it. They go right on past it, Colossians 2:17. Go right past it, not understanding it. He's saying that all these things of the law, the festivals, the new moons, the Sabbath days, the sacrifices, the ceremonies, they were all a shadow of what was to come. Who was to come? Christ. They were all a shadow. He says the substance belongs to Christ. This entire substance of the Old Testament law that was given, the ceremonies and the feasts and the sacrifices, they all point to Jesus. And I really wish we did have 500 minutes to take you through a study of the Old Testament law and show you exactly how the guilt offering in the first few chapters of Leviticus showed how Jesus Christ would be sacrificed for our guilt. And the burnt offering, and the grain offering, the peace offering, the fellowship offering. As you go on and on and on, every one of them points to Jesus Christ. And as you go on through the book of Leviticus, that book that's so full of Jewish law that almost no Christian reads that book, it's one of my favorite books, if not the favorite book that I have, because the whole thing prophetically points to Christ. You go through, and it says things like, this is the ceremony for the, this is the law for the leper on the day of his cleansing. And you say, yawn. But what it really is, it's a prophecy of Jesus Christ coming down from heaven and being put in an earthen vessel, a human body, and being nailed to a wooden cross and dying. And in that earthen vessel, water and blood mixing together. And of his resurrection from the dead and his ascension back into heaven. And then as you get on into chapter 23 of Leviticus and all these feasts are lined up, God calls them holy convocations. And that word convocations in Hebrew, translated several ways, convocations in our New American Standard Bible. But the word literally means rehearsals. He says, I want you, these seven feasts of the year, I want you to rehearse this. And he tells them to rehearse the Passover. They were rehearsing it. They would take the lamb, and the lamb would be killed, and the blood applied to their homes, and the judgment of God passing over their homes. Rehearsing when the Lamb of God, Jesus Christ, would be killed, and his blood applied to our lives. Causes God's judgment to pass over us. Right after that, the Feast of Unleavened Bread commanded to be celebrated with unleavened bread without yeast, a picture of being sinless, was a rehearsal of the burial of the sinless body of Jesus Christ. The Sunday morning after that, the Feast of First Fruits, a celebration, a rehearsal, a looking forward to, if you would, of Jesus Christ, the first fruits from among the dead, being raised from the tomb, raised from the dead. And then many weeks after that, 7 weeks, 49 days, 50 days, the Feast of Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks. When they were to take two loaves of leavened bread, the only offering that God received, by the way, that included leaven, it was two loaves of equal size. It was a new offering. And it looked forward to the day of Pentecost, when Jesus Christ would give birth to the church by calling sinners from all over, both Jews and Gentiles, two leavened loaves of equal weight in this new thing that he was doing, birthing the church. And then as we continue on, the Feast of Trumpets, pointing to when the trumpet, the last trump will blow and Christ raptures his church. And then the Day of Atonement, when during, at the end of the Great Tribulation, when the Jews will cry out for their true Messiah after they've been deceived by the Antichrist, a false Messiah. And they say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. On the Day of Atonement, when they humble themselves and confess their sin, cry out to God. And then the Feast of Tabernacles, when Christ will return and establish his kingdom, ruling and reigning from Mount Zion, there on Temple Mount as we know it today. And he will, where the scripture says he will once again tabernacle among his people. The Feast of Tabernacles pointed to that time when God would once again tabernacle among his people. Do you see how this whole, and we could just go on and on and on and on, how the Old Testament law, the ceremonies and things, they pointed to what was to come, to Christ. That the feasts themselves were just a shadow of what was to come, but the substance of them was Christ. And he's saying, I can't believe, Paul is saying to the Galatians, I can't believe that you have come to know Christ. The law pointed to Christ. You've come to know Christ, and now you're going back to the law that pointed you to Christ. It would be as if a friend of yours called you up and said, hey, I've set you up on a blind date. Well, you say, I'm married. I can't go on a blind date. You need to get new friends. Let's assume you're single. Let's assume that you're single. And your friend calls you up, hey, I've set you up on a blind date. Here's a picture of the person. And you go, wow, this is a really fine looking person. And you're fascinated with the photograph, and you can't wait for Friday night when that blind date, when you're going to meet at the restaurant. And so you meet up with that person at the restaurant, and you're just enthralled with the person, fascinated, having great conversation. And you're thinking, I could spend the rest of my life with this person. I could consider marrying this person. But then for some strange reason, you pull the photograph out of your pocket, and you begin to look at the photograph again, ignoring your date. You're paying attention to a photograph of your date. Well, number one, that's offensive to the person across the table, isn't it? Because you're saying that's not me. That's a representation of me. That's a mere shadow of me. I'm the substance. I'm right here. How could you turn back to the photograph? You see how ridiculous that is? It'd be like if, let's say your family all week long, you've seen this commercial for a great movie that's coming up, and the commercial's exciting and lots of, just like, oh man, the whole family's really excited to see this. We've been watching this commercial on TV. And so Sunday after church, you pack it up, you grab some lunch, then you go off to the movie. And you're really enjoying the movie, and the movie's fascinating, and halfway through the movie, you get up and go home and turn on the TV hoping to catch the commercial again. Does that make any sense? The commercial just pointed you to the movie, but when you finally experienced the movie, you turned away and went back to the commercial. It would be like enjoying a great Stouffer's microwave dinner, and halfway through that chicken Dijon or whatever, you start thinking about that box that it came in, and you go back to the kitchen trash and dig it out, and Do you see how foolish that is? The foolishness of observing the law and observing the feasts and the new moons and the Sabbath days, they all pointed to Jesus Christ. Now that we know Jesus Christ, we don't need to go back to the picture. We don't need to go back to the commercial. We don't need to go back to the TV dinner box. We've got the real thing. And so he's saying, I just don't understand how you're doing that. In verse 12, he says, I beg of you, brethren, become as I am, for I also have become as you are. You have done me no wrong, but you know that it was because of a bodily illness that I preached the gospel to you the first time. He's saying, become as I am, for I have become as you are. He's saying, I wish that you guys, you know, the Galatians were Gentiles. He said, I wish that you guys were just good old Gentile born-again Christians. That's what I wish you were. Become as I am, because I became as you are. Paul was a Jew among Jews. He was Saul of the tribe of Benjamin, a Pharisee of Pharisees, educated by Gamaliel. There was no Jew that was up and coming like Paul or like Saul of Tarsus was. But he gave all that up. He didn't observe those things. He wasn't under the law. He was just a good old Christian. And he fellowshipped with Gentile Christians, and he preached the word to Gentile non-Christians, and he wanted to be all things to all men. So he's saying, would you become as I am? Because I became as you are. And he says, would you remember? Now, he's reminding them that he wasn't looking for money, when he came to him, he didn't have this ulterior motive. The reason he even stopped there in the region of Galatia, says, was because of a bodily illness. He says, it was because of a bodily illness that I preached the gospel to you the first time. And that which was a trial to you in my bodily condition, you did not despise or loathe. But you received me as an angel of God, as Christ Jesus himself. So apparently Paul's bodily illness was pretty gross. It was a trial to whoever had to take care of him, something that might be despised or loathed. He says, where then is that sense of blessing you had? For I bear you witness, and here we get an idea of what that bodily illness might have been. For I bear you witness that if possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me. This is one of several places where Bible scholars get the idea that Paul's affliction, infirmity in the flesh, was a horrible, gross disease of the eyes. You know, you see, as he writes in the scriptures, see with what large letters I write with my own hand, as he signs off on a letter that he'd been dictating, having to write with really large letters, and the Galatians saying, oh, we'd pluck out our eyes and give them to you if we could. So it seems like Paul's problem was an eye problem. Now, of course, that wouldn't have done any good. He said, you would have if you could, but they couldn't because it wouldn't have done any good. I mean, back then, you figure 2,000 years ago, I pluck out my eye and go to give it to you, and well, I've got one less eye, and you still got an eye problem. But nowadays, you know, with transplants and things, it's not an impossibility anymore. And something that's gotten me thinking this week was a news story I picked up off the wire last October when Indonesia elected a new president. Indonesia's new president, a Muslim cleric, his name's Abdurrahman Wahid. That's a good name for kids, you know. Anyway, Abdurrahman Wahid, a Muslim cleric, he's actually suffered two severe strokes, and because of that, he's nearly blind. He's almost completely blind. He's a new president and is almost completely blind. Well, his Muslim followers, you know, worshipers of Allah, not the true and living God, but a false God, a mean God. If you read about Allah, he's just a mean guy. These worshipers of a false God, they have such a sense of following, of loyalty to this leader, both religiously and politically, that one by one, two by two, dozens by dozens, hundreds by hundreds of people have come forward since October, offering to donate their eyes so that he would be able to do his job rightly. Coming forward and saying, I would go blind so that you as my president could see. To see if they, well, no pun intended, but to see if they were a compatible donor, if the transplant could be done. And you know, as I think of that, as I think of the Galatians with this sense of blessing, as Christians, with the sense of blessing that they had, to actually pluck out their eyes and give them to Paul, I'm humbled. And when I think about these Muslims, devotees of Islam, willing to donate their eyes, I'm ashamed. Because I'm supposed to be like Jesus. And I like to think that I'm a very giving person. I like to think that, man, I'd give you the shirt off my back to bless you. But in reality, do I have that sense of blessing? I would ask you, do you have that sense of blessing? Sure, lots of us are willing to chip in a few bucks for a worthy cause. You know, we're Christians, we're good folks. How about a kidney to a total stranger? That's different, isn't it? You're like, well, yeah, that's my body. That's giving my body to people. Jesus gave his whole body. And so when I think, how far am I really willing to go to be a blessing to somebody? At what price am I really willing to pay? What sacrifice am I really willing to make to meet someone's need? when I think of these things, I have to admit, I am not nearly as much like Jesus as I like to think I am. Now, I don't say this to bring condemnation and say, you know, you really should be donating blood every other week and you really should give up, you know, every, you know, lots of you have two organs, right? You got two kidneys and you got two eyes and you got, I don't remember what else you have two of, but two lungs. Well, you should be giving them away. No, I'm not saying that. And you know what? If I was to say that, if I was to say, if you were a real Christian, you'd be donating a kidney. You'd be donating an eye. You'd be making sacrifices like Jesus made sacrifices. You know what that is? That's the same bondage of religion that Paul's been warning us about for weeks in the book of Galatians. It's that same bondage. The trick is not to say, oh, I guess I got to go donate some stuff so I'll be a good Christian. The trick is, I got to be tight with Jesus. I've got to be in prayer. I've got to be in the Word. I've got to be in relationship with Jesus, because the more I hang out with Him, the more like Him I am. And the more like Him I am, the more I'm naturally going to sacrifice, and it's not going to be this big burden of bondage of religion. It's like, oh man, that's great. See, I could get up here and I could teach. I go, hey, the law says that you need to tithe 10%. So if you're coming here, you better be tithing exactly 10% of your income. And I might convince many of you and might alienate and drive out many of you. But, you know, you're writing that check, 10%. Okay, my check this week was $562.10. So I write my check for $56.21. And it's just this big bondage. But if I just say, hey, man, grow in the Lord. Worship God. And I share with you, or you in your own devotions find out that God says, hey, give back a portion to me. Bless me financially and I'll bless you abundantly. Then you go, oh man, I love God so much, I'm gonna write that check. And you know, it doesn't matter how much it is. Maybe it's instead of $56, it's $156. See, what the religion did was put you in bondage to 10%. But hey, if grace supersedes the law, then you might be 15%, 20%, 25%. You see what a blessing it is to be under grace in a relationship with God than putting people under bondage and putting yourself under bondage. And so when I say, do you have the sense of blessing that the Galatians had? I'm not saying, look how short you fall. I'm saying, we need to be more like Jesus. How do we get there? Not by our actions, but by being close to the Lord. And the actions follow through. The actions are just fruit. Fruit of our relationship with God. So, he says, where is that sense of blessing you had? Notice, too, that when they were on fire, when they heard the gospel and received it, and they were just so thrilled to be saved by grace, they had a huge sense of blessing. But now that they're under bondage, religion, there's no more sense of blessing. There's no heart for God's people. I've been so blessed by the congregation here, just to see how they reach out to one another and how they love one another, and they want to bless one another. But I know other people in very religious churches. They're very observant of the law. And they don't care about each other at all. It's the same way with the Galatians. They had a sense of blessing when they were saved by grace. It was a result of relationship with God. But when it was religion, it meant nothing. No more sense of blessing here. And Paul says in verse 16, have I therefore become your enemy by telling you the truth? They eagerly seek you, not commendably, but they wish to shut you out in order that you may seek them. It's good always to be eagerly sought in a commendable manner, and not only when I am present with you. He's saying, I'm seeking after you. I'm pressing towards you. I'm trying to rescue you from this. I'm seeking after you. He says, they're seeking after you, but not for a good reason. And he points out how they're doing it. It was so subtle. You ever heard of reverse psychology? The Judaizers. Remember, the Judaizers were the guys that were trying to put these people under bondage to the law. You got to be like a Jew if you're really going to be a Christian. And so the Judaizers were seeking after to put them under bondage. But the way they sought after them was that reverse psychology. They shut them out. Oh, you're not practicing the Jewish law. I'm sorry, I can't fellowship with you. you know, that spiritual superiority. Have you ever experienced that spiritual superiority? It's like, maybe you're in a church and it's like, oh, you don't speak in tongues? I'm sorry. You know, it's like, maybe someday God will bless you that way. You know, and suddenly it's like, I'm a big Christian and you're a little Christian. Have you ever experienced that? They shut you out. It makes you desire. It's like, man, I want to be part of that group. They seem so blessed and they seem to have shut the doors on me. There must be something really good behind those doors. It wasn't good. It was bondage. It was religion. I like to illustrate things using the Old Testament or using the stories from the Scriptures to illustrate a point. I couldn't think of one. As I was praying about it, one just kept running through my head. It's not a biblical illustration. It's actually probably from your childhood, if you remember the story of Tom Sawyer. You remember Tom Sawyer? This is in chapter 2 of Tom Sawyer, by the way. I can't give you a verse. It wasn't broken up into verses. In chapter 2 of Tom Sawyer, you remember that Aunt Polly ordered Tom to whitewash the fence, you know, paint it white. Well, he would rather have been fishing or swimming in the pond or doing something else. And he's sitting here painting the fence, and along comes Ben, what's his name, so he gets this great plan. Ben's talking to him, but he pretends not to notice. And, hey, Tom, didn't you hear me? Oh, I'm sorry. I was just consumed with this job here. He's like, yeah, bummer you had to whitewash the fence. Oh, no, it's not every day a guy gets to whitewash a fence. What do you mean? You know, it's like, oh, this is pretty special stuff here. You know, I've been entrusted with this. And as he keeps misrepresenting this, the kid starts saying, could I try that? Oh, no, sorry, you know, it's really important, you know. Oh, come on, please. No, I couldn't. I'll give you my apple core. Woo-hoo. No, I couldn't. Okay, I'll give you the whole apple. All right, but only for a little bit. So this kid starts painting the fence. You know, by the end of the afternoon, he had bankrupted every kid in town, you know. He had a frog, he had a kitten with one eye, he had a yo-yo with no string. He just had pocketfuls of all this stuff, a blue piece of glass to look through, you know. He made out like a bandit. See, the way he did it was that reverse psychology. If you shut somebody out, they want to get in. Now, Mark Twain, at the end of that little bit of the story, says Tom had discovered a great law of human action without knowing it. Namely, that in order to make a man or a boy covet a thing, it is only necessary to make the thing difficult to attain. That's a great essay on religion. If you want to make somebody covet something, want it, just make it difficult. You want a relationship with God? It's going to be hard. You want to be part of our group? Oh, you're going to have to follow some rules. You want to speak in tongues? You got to be really holy. The Corinthians spoke in tongues. They weren't holy. And so we see that they were seeking after them by trying to shut them out. And by the end of the whole thing, they were putting in bondage. They were knocking down the doors of the Judaizers saying, please let me in. I want to be in bondage to the law. It just made no sense to Paul. He says, my children, with whom I am again in labor until Christ is formed in you, well, I could wish to be present with you now and to change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. Tell me, you who want to be under law, do you not listen to the law? And what Paul is about to do here is he's about to use some Old Testament illustrations, beginning with one regarding Abraham, to say, if you want to be in bondage to the Old Testament, you better read the Old Testament and understand exactly what it's saying. He says, for it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the bondwoman and one by the free woman. But the son by the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and the son of the free woman through the promise. Now, if you haven't read the book of Genesis recently, maybe that doesn't make a lot of sense to you. But remember Abraham. Abraham was about 100 years old. His wife Sarah was about 90 years old. She was barren. She couldn't have any children. But God had promised that he would have children. He said, through your descendants, you know, you're going to have all these descendants, and through your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Well, God certainly couldn't have my 90-year-old infertile wife have a baby, so now what am I going to do? His wife came up with the idea, well, what about my Egyptian maidservant, my slave, my maid, Hagar? you could have a baby with her, and that way you could have descendants, and then God's promise would be fulfilled. Well, you know, Abraham thought it was a good idea. I'm not making any comment. We're just going on. And so they did, in fact, conceive, and they had a boy. The boy's name was Ishmael. Well, later on, God came to Abraham and said, Abraham, I'm gonna fulfill that promise. And he's, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. No, Abraham, it doesn't work that way. When I make a promise, I fulfill a promise. I don't wait for you to finagle your way into making it look like I did the promise. No, your wife Sarah, in her old age, in her barrenness, will have a child. And in fact, she did. She conceived. She gave birth to a child whose name was Isaac. And Isaac was the heir of the promised child. He was the descendant through which all those promises would be fulfilled. You can't do God's things in the flesh. You can't do it. Much as you'd like to think that, oh, I can just, as long as the ends turns out okay, the means is justified. No, the ends never justifies the means. I've been aghast in the last couple weeks of ministry watching Christians coming for godly counsel and giving them biblical counsel, and they completely disregard it. They pursue their own, looking for their own ends, and they gain their ends, but they will pay the price for the means that they went through. Don't try and fulfill God's promises in the flesh. Don't do it. You get Ishmaels that way. Isaac was the promised child. And so what he's saying is, he had two sons, one by the bondwoman, one by the free woman, but the son of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and the son of the free woman through the promise. So he says, this is allegorically speaking, for these women are two covenants, one proceeding from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be slaves. She's Hagar. So he's saying, okay, now typologically, you could look at Hagar, the bondwoman that was done through the flesh. He says, she's like Mount Sinai, where they got the Ten Commandments that the Jews are in bondage under. He says, this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. So he's saying, yeah, it's okay, you've got these people under slavery, the Jews, under the law. He says, but the Jerusalem above, that new Jerusalem, the heavenly city, is free. She is our mother, for it is written, rejoice, barren woman, and who does not bear. Break forth and shout, you who are not in labor, for more are the children of the desolate than of the one who has a husband. And you, brethren, like Isaac, are children of promise. He's saying, you're not born of bondage. You're born of freedom. You're the heir of the promise. You're child of God. But as at that time he was born according to the flesh, persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, so it is now also. If you go back to Genesis 21, verses 9 and 10, I think, you see that there was mocking going on. There was Ishmael, who was, you know, a few years, 12 or 14 years older than Isaac, so he's probably picking on the little kid. But then Hagar was making fun of Sarah. Oh, look, there's the old woman with the baby, you know, and mocking them. And the end result of that whole thing and that persecution was to drive the bondwoman out. Hagar got kicked out. So he says, but what does the scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be an heir with the son of the free woman. He's saying, Galatians, that's the same thing that's happening now. There's persecution going on. There's slaves, people in bondage to the law, and then there's you who were free. And those people in bondage to the law, we're persecuting you and putting you under bondage. He says, so then, brethren, we are not children of a bondwoman, but of the free woman. Okay, so you understand that chapter. I think it makes sense. But now how does this translate? How does this kind of go into your life? If I was to summarize, I would say this whole thing says this. It's not about religion. It's about relationship. It's not about a religion that makes you do things. It's about a relationship with God, who you know. And a lot of us in the Christian church are in the same place that the Galatians have been put under, in that we may have been labored over in vain because we get to this point where we've got all this religion, but we don't have any relationship. Let me ask you this. Do you have a fish on your car? Do you have a cross on a necklace around your neck? Do you have a WWJD bracelet? Do you wear Christian t-shirts? Do you listen to Christian music? Do you have Christian friends? Okay, you're part of the Christian culture. And from the outside, everybody says, oh, Christian. But when was the last time you just spent time with God? When was the last time you prayed something besides, Jesus, thank you for this food? When was the last time you really worshiped God? Not just sang the songs at church. I'm talking about really worshiped God. When was the last time you spent time just opening up the Word and said, Lord, you're my Lord. Speak to me. The biggest deception in the church today is that of our Christian culturehood. That we think that as long as a person's listening to DC talk and wearing a fish on his shirt and has a dove on his car and has Christian friends, we think they're okay. But that can be your modern day religion if you don't have a relationship with God. I think it's time that the church stopped looking so much at the outside of the cup and started looking at the inside. What's on our inside? Do we really earnestly desire a relationship with God? Let's not be in bondage. Let's be in right relationship with the Lord. Let's just bow our hearts and consider that for a moment before God.